For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up this week, Vicky Goldie reveals how working for RNIB and her own personal circumstances informed the character of her blind detective. Tim Finch discusses his novel Peace Talks, which has been shortlisted for a Costa Award, and Annabelle shares a cautionary tale in her new rom-com We Just Clicked. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Over the years, a number of authors have attempted to write crime novels featuring a blind sleuth, most notably Ernest Brahmer with his Max Carrados mysteries. But few have had the insight to do so without resorting to stereotypes. However, Vicky Goldie is better qualified than most. And with the publication of her second novel in a trilogy featuring blind World War I veteran Major Alistair Charters, I was keen to find out more about the series and Vicky's own story. She joined me from her home in Poole. Vicky Goldie, welcome to Read On.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Red.
So, can you introduce us to Major Alistair Charters and his wife, the Honourable Melissa?
Major Alistair Charters is in his mid to late 20s. He was wounded in World War I and he was blinded. He was in the trenches and then he got recruited, because he was very good at languages, to be part of the Special Operations Network. So he actually worked as a spy behind enemy lines. And he was attacked from behind, and unfortunately both his retinas were detached, so he was instantly blinded. He had recently married the Honourable Melissa Charters, so it's been quite a rough road for them, really, because, you know, she married this dashing major who then came back from the war blind. And for someone who was very active, as he was, it's been quite a rough ride for him. And he also has shell shock, which we today know as PTSD, which I think was part of suddenly you're this active person and then suddenly to be made blind is a terrible thing. Melissa is quite naive. She's an aristocrat. She likes to think that she's a socialist, and she helps him. She's his eyes. So when they start sleuthing, she describes things from him, and from that he works things out. And of course, like my husband, his hearing is extremely acute. So is Alistair's. So he tends to hear things and smell things, and he's also very intuitive. So he's an excellent detective.
You mention that your husband is blind and you also used to work for the RNIB library. So unlike a lot of authors who've attempted to write blind sleuths, you have a lot of insight into how those of us who are blind don't have superpowers. We're just a lot better at, as you say, listening and interpreting the clues that our other senses provide.
Yes, that's correct. Part of the reason I started writing the books was to try and present a positive, although he's got lots of problems, Alistair, is to create a positive image about blind people are able to do lots of different things. And that's why I wanted to write books featuring someone who's blind, to create a positive image, because so many people over the years have said to my husband, oh, you can't possibly be blind, or, oh, you can't do that, you're blind. And you think, well, of course he can. You know, he's not turned into an idiot just because he's blind. So I really wanted to try and write something that was positive and featured a young person who's blind. I really find it extraordinary that people think blind people are basically unable to do anything. I recently went into a bank and I was doing my husband's banking, because banks are very difficult. I don't know whether you find it so for blind people, with all the pins and this and that and everything else. So I said, well, I'm actually doing this for my husband who's blind. You know, it's very difficult that I have to do his banking for him. And she said, oh, bless. Are you his carer? I went, no, he runs a business, for goodness sake. So it really does. Every time I meet someone like that, it makes me want to write the books more, to try and show that young blind people really go ahead and can do whatever they want.
You reflect that in Alistair and Melissa's relationship. He gets very frustrated with his inability to do the things that he used to be able to do. And Melissa is obviously there to help him, but not so much. She still, and he still, wants to be able to do things by himself.
Yes, very much so. I think it's very similar to the relationship I have with my husband and I've always had with my husband, because, you know, he's always wanted to do things he probably shouldn't and are quite dangerous, the rest of us would think. But, you know, that's part of life and exploring it. I think as a blind person and as a spouse, you have to sort of stand back and let them do it, really.
And you've set the book in the golden age of crime that we associate with Poirot and Lord Peter Wimsey. And that lack of understanding of the men who've come back mutilated from the First World War, and the assumption Major Alistair just isn't there that some of the guests make, actually allows him to listen and observe almost unobserved.
Yes, he uses it to his advantage. At the beginning, the first book, he's very annoyed by it, and so is Melissa. But actually, as they begin to start their sleuthing career, they realise that they can play on this, accept this prejudice, and use it to their advantage. Of course, I think in the 1920s, it was considerably worse than it is today. And there was always the feeling that officers who did come back mutilated should really either disappear quietly somewhere or should shoot themselves, because they didn't want to be reminded of the war, which is terrible.
You're a massive fan of that golden age of crime, and there's certainly a touch of Agatha Christie's Partners in Crime, Tommy and Tuppence stories in this book, both with the whodunit element and also the humour.
Yes, I try to inject some humour, because I think what a lot of people who haven't read the books don't realise, that there is a lot of humour in the Agatha Christie books. Certainly the Poirot on television got darker and darker and darker, and now in its modern incarnation is very, very dark. But her books are, although they're dealing with murder and psychological issues, there is humour in them, which makes them easy reads and fun.
And there's always an alluring cast of characters, usually with a dubious European countess and a fussy old colonel, all gathered in a country house. And that's clearly the element that you love. Both your novels, Blind Witness and Blind Pool, are country house murders.
Yes, they are. I love the idea of there being this group of people. Someone's done it. Who was it? And then peeling back the layers and looking to see who it is.
Do you start the novel knowing who's done it, or do you allow the characters to decide for themselves as you write?
Well, with book one, I was pretty sure who did it. Then suddenly someone else did it. So not always. With book two, I was pretty sure who did it, and that person, it ended up that way. So I think sometimes when you write, the characters can sometimes take over and take you by surprise, or you see something opening that you didn't realise at the time when you did your plan of how the novel was going to go. So I think you have to be flexible and see who's going to end up being the murderer.
And what do you think are the essential ingredients for a classic whodunit?
I think you have to have a cast of disparate characters, some that you like, some that you won't like, but you need to have one character that you warm to, otherwise why would you care who got killed? I think there also has to be quite a lot of suspense. The page has to turn. You have to want to find out who did it, and that's what I think is the most important ingredient, is getting that suspense and sense of tension right, so that your reader wants to finish the book.
And do you need an isolated place, like a country house or a train travelling through the countryside?
It certainly helps, because it gives you the boundaries. Some detective novels, you're sort of ranging all across the place, and it's more about the places they visit than actually about the essential nitty-gritty of the crime and who did it.
I must say, I always like to have a creaking door or two. I think that's the essential ingredient.
Yes, absolutely.
And you've got a great eye for detail. There is wonderful descriptions of the clothes and the crockery and the house and its occupants as well. Clearly, you've done an awful lot of research into that Art Deco age.
Yes, thank you. I do love the Art Deco age, and I always have done. Many, many years ago, we lived near Portobello Road, and in the 70s, I used to do quite a lot of collecting when it was really cheap. Of course, it's now very expensive. So I love all that sort of thing. And yes, I have had to do a lot of research, mainly on silly things like what would they have done for a refrigerator? And in the second book, obviously, they're cut off. And then you think, well, where did they get their electricity from? Where did they get the water from? You know, all those things that we take for granted, heat and light, in those days was quite different. So I've had to do a lot of research on boilers and electrical systems.
And when Major Alistair is doing his sleuthing, do you run his actions past your husband just to say, would you do that or would you do it slightly differently?
Yes, he is my go-to person for lots of things in the book, and he sort of edits it at the end. We go through it in minute detail, and he goes, oh, I don't think I'd have done that. So, yes, we do look at it and see. And sometimes he surprises me and said, no, I'd have done that. Why don't you get me to do this? So it's quite interesting, the things he can do.
So does he see himself as a Poirot or a Lord Peter Wimsey or maybe an Albert Campion?
No, I don't think he does. I just think he likes to sort of see what one could do in those circumstances. Crime is one of his favourite things that he reads as well, but he tends to read modern stuff rather than the older stuff.
Do you have a favourite author from the golden age of crime?
I have to say, of course, it is Agatha Christie, but I do read lots of novels that were out of print. And so I'm now reading books by E.C.R. Lorac, for example, and she writes very interesting murder mysteries. And there are lots of different books like that that we haven't been able to read for 20, 30 years. So it's fascinating. At that time, there were hundreds and hundreds of authors writing excellent murder mysteries, and Agatha was just one of them.
As far as blind detectives of yesteryear are concerned, are there any that stand out to you as having offered accurate portrayals?
It's a difficult one, that. I think probably the Inspector French novels. He is a detective and he's very solid and he's very meticulous in the way he runs his investigation. And what's quite fascinating about a detective in that period, he did it on his own mostly, you know, and he was catching the train and buses and things like that that you don't even think about. You know, he wasn't roaring around in a staff car. So I find them very interesting.
Now, you yourself were a librarian for the R&IB for some years.
Yes.
And the R&IB Talking Books Library was founded by a blind veteran of World War One. So did Major Alistair have his genesis in those years?
Probably, because I was actually working for the R&IB School of Physiotherapy as the librarian there. And therefore, a lot of the physiotherapists who had qualified were veterans who had been blinded through the Second World War. I knew one quite well who'd been blinded during the Mau Mau rebellion in Africa. And so I think it sat there in the back of my mind that these were people who had stories to tell and needed to be brought forth into the mind of the public.
Well, we're very fortunate that you have done so, and fingers crossed, audiobook versions of both the first novel, Blind Witness, and the second, Blind Pool, should be on the way in 2021. If you could have your perfect narrator, who would he be?
I've thought about this, and I do think it needs to probably be a man, one who has that sort of warmth, and who also is quite young, because what I really wanted to do was make these novels about young people, because there are so many detective stories about older people, like the excellent Richard Osman's new book, The Thursday Murder Club, but they are living in an old people's home, you know, and I think people think that's funny because of Miss Marple and Poirot being old. But I think we need to mix it up and have some nice young people solving mysteries.
And that Art Deco glamour would certainly fit the bright young things who are gathering in the country house for the murder.
Yes, absolutely. Right to be killed off.
Vicky Goldie, thank you so much for introducing us to Major Alistair Charters and his wife, the Honourable Melissa. I, for one, am certainly hoping that the audiobook versions will be forthcoming next year. But in the meantime, good luck with the third book in the trilogy.
Thank you very much.
Both Blind Witness and Vicky Goldie's latest novel, Blind Pool, are available commercially wherever you buy your books.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The RNIB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles, and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer, or other reading devices. RNIB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished, and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format. Enjoy a selection of e-braille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the Reading Services Library or any other of the great RNIB services we offer.
This year, Paul Milray contracted COVID-19. Up till then, the 63-year-old had enjoyed a fit and healthy life and was even a fully qualified open water diving instructor in his spare time. The virus left him in intensive care for 6 weeks, where he suffered two major strokes as a result of uncontrollable blood clotting. For several days, his life lay in the balance, but happily he pulled through and is now on the long road to recovery. However, one of the strokes has affected his sight and his ability to read. Always a voracious reader, Paul is now exploring the world of audiobooks and has agreed to record some reviews for us. So, over to you, Paul.
Scales of Justice by Niall Marsh, read by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Nurse Kettle mounted her bicycle and began to coast down Watts Lane. On her left appeared the quickset hedge of Jacob's Cottage. From the far side came the voice of Mr. Octavius Danbury Finn.
Adorable, Mr. Danbury Finn was saying. Queen of delight. Fish.
He was answered by the trill of feline voices. Nurse Kettle brought herself to anchor at the gate. Good evening, she said. There was Mr. Danbury Finn in his Elizabethan garden giving supper to his cats.
This is the 18th work by Niall Marsh, featuring Chief Detective Inspector Roderick Alleyne, and it's clearly a writer at the peak of her powers. The characters are well presented and the plotting is crisp. It begins with a wonderfully named Nurse Kettle cycling through the village and giving us an overview of what it looks like and where people are. But soon this idyllic scene is revealed to be hiding dark secrets. And one of those leads to the death of Colonel Carteret, a retired military man fond of his fishing. Carteret has been asked by the local lord to publish the true story of the lord's wartime exploits. Not bravery, but in fact treason. Treason which did not lead to the lord's disgrace, but led to the death of a younger man. Very quickly we're introduced to the key characters in this book. Danbury Finn, who's a cat lover and fisherman. Mrs. Kitty Carteret, something out of sorts here, slightly louche and enjoys her drink. A similar drink-sodden character, Commander Sice, and the rest of the Lacklander family as well as the Lord, including the majestic Lady Lacklander. The book perfectly divides into three. which corresponds to the number of discs. The first sets out the agenda, sets out the characters, and tells you where to go. The second has the murder and the arrival of Elaine. The third has the resolution after a series of false starts. Now, I happen to like fishing, so that was an extra reason to like this book. But just to be clear, if you don't like fishing, it doesn't matter. This was a really entertaining read. And even though it was published in 1953, it's remarkably fresh. It's far from uncritical of the upper classes. Apparently, this was the author gradually turning against those upper classes. But she's clearly on top of her game as a writer. And Benedict Cumberbatch, what can you say? His reading is beautiful, he brings the characters to life, and he keeps you engaged throughout. Now, when I listen to a book, I don't just like to enjoy it, I like to learn something. And I learned two things here. One, each trout has a different design on it, and each design is unique. And the second, I learned how to pronounce Nio.
Scales of Justice by Nio Marsh, narrated by Benedict Cumberbatch, is available commercially. There is also a wide range of Nio Marsh novels in the RNIB Talking Books library.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, Annabelle explores the perils of posting an idealised portrait of yourself online in her new rom-com, We Just Clicked. But first, this week, the category winners for the 2019 Costa Book Awards were announced. And one of the books in contention for the Costa Novel Award was Peace Talks by Tim Finch, which examines a long-term relationship against the backdrop of ongoing peace negotiations. Tim joined me down the line to tell me more. Welcome to Read On.
Hi.
So, for those who haven't yet read Peace Talks, can you give us the blurb?
Well, the basic idea is that there's this fellow called Edward Berens, who's half Norwegian, half English, and he conducts peace talks. And he is in the Austrian Tyrol with two warring parties trying to bring a conflict to an end. And we follow him through that, and we realise that he's sort of talking about what's happening during his days at these negotiations with someone who's absent. And that's his wife. And it turns out in the end that his wife is no longer alive, but he's speaking to her as though she's still with him, which she, in a sense, very strongly is. And then, as it were, the major reveal in the book is what happened to his wife, how it was that she died. And then, without giving too much away, the idea behind the book in my own head was that we're always trying to reach a place of some peace and resolution in our own lives. And that's a struggle, and there's difficulties, and there's flare-ups, and there's passages where life is a bit more straightforward and simple, but then there are moments of great drama. But in the end, we never reach a total situation of peace. Peace is sort of patched up. It's put together as best it can. And so I suppose it's quite a sad book, I must say. It's quite a sort of elegiac book.
The peace negotiations that are going on are between an unnamed country and insurgents who are trying to overthrow the regime. And it's a novel approach to have that as the backdrop to examine the tensions within a relationship.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I don't want to make too much of the fact that a relationship between two loving individuals is equivalent to two warring parties in a civil war. There's not a direct parallel I'm trying to draw between the two things. In a sense, he takes comfort in these imagined conversations with his wife from the horrors of the world which he faces, which he has to face full on because he's involved daily in negotiating around the most grotesque atrocities, not least. The backdrop of the idea was, how do we find peace in the world? And we find peace in the world through conversation, through dialogue, through reconciliation, and to a certain extent, in just being able to accept the world as it is. And there is a sense in which, by the end, in a way which is far from satisfactory, because his wife remains dead at the end of the book, but he has come to some sort of resolution with the world as it is. And it seems to me as though the conduct of conflicts is often a bit like that. It's very rare, even when a conflict comes to an end and the peace talks have succeeded, that the situation thereafter in the country or countries involved is one of perfect peace. It's the best you have. And so in a sense, the book's exploring the fact that life is in many ways very, very unsatisfactory, and you get your pleasures and your moments of light where you can.
And that's particularly resonant at the moment, as we are removed from a lot of human interaction and maybe have more time on our hands to consider how we interact with other people.
Yes, obviously, any novel is written years before it gets published, or at least started years before it gets published. And so, you know, there is absolutely nothing in my mind when I was writing this book that pertains to this weird situation we're in now. But it's uncanny the way in which themes can emerge that seem relevant to the times now. So anybody who listening to this, who went away and said, I'd read that, would pick up various things, I think. In effect, Edvard and his negotiating team and the two parties to the conflict are in a sort of quarantine situation. They're in isolation up in the mountains. I draw allusions between them being in the mountains in Austria with the sanatorium in Thomas Mann's famous novel Magic Mountain, which is referenced at various times. And so they are, as it were, locked away from the world. So there's that parallel for a start. And then there is this sense, which I think people will be having, of communicating somehow, but not directly, with loved ones who are not with them at the time. Not necessarily or hopefully actually dead, but you know, we're all in a situation now where people who are very close to us, loved ones and dear friends, are absent. So we have things like the thing I'm talking to you on now in order to directly communicate. But there's also a strong sense in which we are all thrown back on our own resources. And then I guess the other theme that there's a parallel between the book and what's happening now is that Edvard, for all that he is active in the world and he's engaged in some of the most important activities you could possibly have, which is trying to resolve conflicts, he's nonetheless a deeply lonely man. And the book is a lot about loneliness and grief and bereavement and how to come to terms with that. And it makes the point, I hope poignantly, that it doesn't really help to have lots of activity and to be around lots of people, including important people, if you're missing the person that you most want to be with, and he is throughout the book.
We don't walk, and negotiations never go as well on those days, mercifully infrequent, when a white fog wipes out the world in front of one's face. Then we breakfast rather later, behind copies of the International Herald Tribune, The Times, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, and the rest. It was Baudelaire, I looked it up online, who railed against this revolting aperitif that the civilized man starts his morning meal with. War, crime, rapine, shamelessness, torture, a delirium of universal atrocity. The point is well made, but the word aperitif has always troubled me. At breakfast? If you're a symbolist poet, I suppose.
Richard Trinder narrating Peace Talks, written by my guest, Tim Finch. Now, you yourself have worked as a journalist for many years. I wondered if some of that sense of having to take an objective view fed into Edvard.
I was a BBC journalist for a number of years, but I was one of the ones who sort of ran away from the sound of gunfire. I was never heroic enough to go to anywhere remotely dangerous. I worked very largely during my career for the BBC at Westminster, which, although a place of a great deal of conflict in some ways, and obviously at the centre of events, is fairly safe from the point of view of not putting yourself in any danger. But the question still is relevant, I think, because it is the case that you observe how people who have important jobs with lots of responsibility and are involved in the world a great deal are nonetheless sometimes quite lonely, poor communicators, don't have great relationships with other people. And I was drawing on a bit of that, I think. And obviously, in any peace negotiations, there's a lot of politics, a lot of silly politics, actually. I mean, I hope I have some fun with some of the absurdities of any political negotiations and the way relationships, you know, highly important things are reduced to tiny, petty points. I've stressed how the book is, on the whole, a serious and sad book. Nonetheless, there are a lot of moments of humour and absurdity, and they come from the elements where, which I've imagined, I have to say, I've never worked in peace negotiations or even been that close to them, but I do know people who have been, particularly around the Northern Ireland conflict, for instance. I've got an old friend who was close to all of the Good Friday agreement discussions, for instance, and he could be quite hilarious about, in the midst of them trying to resolve this dreadful conflict which had torn apart Northern Ireland for more than 20 years, really silly, stupid little tiny things would derail the talks for days and hours. And so I tried to draw some of that into the book as well.
And did you find yourself casting your eye back to any predecessors who'd worked in journalism to become authors, such as Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene, when writing the book?
Any writer is writing in the shadow of all the writers who came before, and obviously particularly the great writers, the writers of the canon in some sense. And so, you know, of course, I have read lots of Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh and Hemingway and people like that. So they're in there in the mix of what I understand writing to be about. And I guess in the sense that this is a book which mixes the sort of political with the personal, there are some parallels between the two writers you named in some of their writing. I think perhaps particularly Greene, because Greene obviously in a number of his more serious novels at least really grapples with these issues of guilt and responsibility and death and mortality and all those sorts of things. I'm making it sound a bit heavier than it is, and there are elements. The war parallel perhaps might be that the book at times has some sort of comic set pieces, which I hadn't thought of before, but now you mention it, might have some resonances there. And as I say, I had in my mind a little bit the slightly sort of narcotic, lethargic atmosphere that goes with Mann's Magic Mountain. That's alluded to a few times. So like any book, you can see allusions and references there if you've read these previous writers. But if you haven't read anything by any of those other people, I think you could read this book fairly straightforwardly. It's not a book that wears its literary allusions that heavily, I don't think.
And is there a freedom in writing fiction that you don't have in being a journalist?
Oh, definitely. And I'm a late starter in writing, or at least being published. But, you know, one of the reasons I've always wanted to do it is that I'm sort of more interested in the questions that come through exploring your own imagination and your own mind than I am in the world as it actually is. I don't do much research for my novels. I draw obviously on my own experiences to some extent, and I've got, you know, everything that I've ever read and heard about and seen on the television and the radio to draw on, but I don't do a huge amount of research on something because I'm not really sure that that's what novels are for. If someone was to say to me, that isn't how peace talks are negotiated, or you got that thing wrong, I'd just go, well, that doesn't really matter. It isn't important to me, particularly that the absolute details are right. It's an imagined set of peace talks. It is not designed to just say, this is what peace talks are really like.
Now, the book has been made into a rather fine audiobook by Richard Trinder. Did you have anything to do with his selection to read the book?
Only in the sense that the publishers very generously said, we're thinking of using Richard Trinder to record the book. Do you have any objection? And of course, I didn't. I mean, he's an actor of great pedigree, and they sent me some examples of him doing audiobooks in the past, and they hired someone very good. I have to say, I hadn't heard the book, and I actually quite liked it. Someone the other day was saying to me, have you read the book recently? And of course I haven't. It's, you know, actually ages since I sat down and went through it. You know, more recently did copy editing and what have you, but that's a grueling and horrible way of reading any book, never mind your own. So in a strange way, you know, in this situation where you talk about the book, it's sometime afterwards, and sometimes I even struggle to remember little things. People tell me things and I can't remember them. But I would actually like to hear the audio version just to sort of see what he's made of it. So someone said to me at the weekend, are you going to do that? And I said I was going to. And now you've mentioned it, I think I'll listen to it as well. Not all of it, I hasten to add, because this book obviously is sort of imprinted on my mind, really. But I'd like to hear how it's done.
Well, I think you're in for a treat. Generally, are you a fan of audiobooks?
I have to say I'm not, no. And I don't mean that in the sense that I have any objection to them, but I'm a sighted person and I can read books in the sort of most traditional way. I mean, I don't read them on Kindles either. I read actual physical books, and I've always liked reading actual physical books. And I have barely ever consumed a book via the audio version. Once or twice when travelling abroad many years ago, more with sort of cassette tape type things, I've done it. But no, it's not the way I generally do it.
Well, Tim Finch, thank you so much for introducing us to the book and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Peace Talks by Tim Finch is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio.
It's not difficult to donate a little to RNIB. In fact, it's as easy as treating yourself to the latest CD, digital device, or Amazon Echo. Raise money for RNIB whilst you shop at Amazon. Amazon Smile is a simple and automatic way for you to support RNIB every time you shop, at no cost to you. When you next sign in to Amazon, use the address www.smile.amazon.co.uk and nominate RNIB as your charity of choice. The webpage looks exactly like amazon.co.uk and it remembers all of your login details, order history, wish lists, wedding lists, etc. But importantly, RNIB will receive 0.5% of the net sale of most goods that you can buy on the site. It's that easy to donate. Tell your friends and family how simple it is to donate to RNIB every time you shop on Amazon, simply by using www.smile.amazon.co.uk. Treat yourself on Amazon and support your favourite charity while you shop.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. And now, a cautionary tale.
If you've ever been tempted to present a perfect profile on your Instagram page, then Annabelle's latest novel, We Just Clicked, could give you pause for thought. As with her previous romantic comedies, it's packed with snappy dialogue, awkward situations, and great good humour. Anna joined me to tell me more about the book and her life as a writer. Anna, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you.
So, can you tell us a bit about the new book?
Well, my new book is called We Just Clicked, and it's a fun rom-com about an Instagram influencer wannabe called Izzy, who really wants to become a massive Instagram influencer and quit her job and change her life, and she can't seem to get there. So when her work colleague suggests that they fake date to boost their profiles, she jumps at the chance, and their Instagram star starts to rise, and it all seems to work. But then she meets Aiden, who is a man that she'd met briefly a few years before, and she starts to fall in love with him. And soon she's faced this dilemma as to whether she chooses real sort of true love or whether she chooses fame and fortune.
Aiden is really rather perfect and doesn't do Instagram. But Luke, who she does have this fake online relationship with, is a real creep, isn't he?
Well, he is really. I mean, you always got to have a sort of a pantomime villain in a book. And I think that Luke is the perfect one. Sometimes I think that Luke has some redeemable qualities and you almost think that he's going to be a great guy. But no, he is a bit of a creep. Yes. With his perfect abs and his perfect hair. Yes.
Yes. He's always checking his quiff.
Yes, absolutely. He has to have it all perfect. And it sort of makes me laugh a little bit because with Instagram, everything's all about the image. But most people leave it when they're off screen. But Luke carries it over his whole life like he's almost in character the whole time.
Social media really is ideal for rom-coms, isn't it? I know your last book, it started with a tweet concentrated on how we like to project ourselves differently online to in person. It's clearly an area that's tickled your funny bone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that's so relatable to everybody, because even though I think that I'm quite real on social media, I know that I'm not, because everything, you know, there's always a judgment about what you put on, isn't it? So I think that's what always really fascinates me when I go to write a book. It's sort of about what's popular right now, what people can identify with and what sort of make people laugh, because I think it's quite a funny thing. I think people like to see this behind the scenes view of social media.
And while some people might think, oh, this is all very new, if you look back at some of the earliest novels from Jane Austen and round about that time, A lot of them were epistolatory. A lot of them were people sending letters to each other and presenting themselves in quite a different way from the way that we actually end up finding that they are.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of true of all novels, especially when you, obviously the Jane Austen novels, when she set them, they were a contemporary set. And that's just like us. And we just, I guess, use our world as a mirror or a window into it. So I think that to write a novel set today without social media would be quite difficult.
It's the media that changes, not the people who are writing in that media.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the same kind of thing, isn't it, really? The stories are all the same. It's still about people falling in love, people getting themselves into difficulty because of what they've done on the media, or whether it's it's by letter or by email or on tweets. You can all identify it. I think that's why we still love Jane Austen books, because you can still identify with them today, because it's that sort of social aspect.
Did you grow up as a big fan of Jane Austen and novels such as that?
Not really. I mean, I did read Jane Austen and I did read Jane Eyre and some of the Bronte sisters. But my passion really was in 90s rom-coms, really. Jane Green, Freya North, books like that, that was very modern, and single girl about town books. And I absolutely loved them because they were such a contrast to anything that I had read before. And I think that's why I've sort of ultimately gone that route.
And I believe that there's rather a good story about how you became an author yourself.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, I'd always sort of wanted to be a writer, but at the time I was a museum curator and I thought that was my professional career for life. And I'd always been a big fan of the TV show The Apprentice. And I'd written quite a witty, what I thought was a witty application to go on the show. And I went for an interview and it was absolutely atrocious because I was put on the spot and I had to speak in front of directors and people. And I just went to pieces. And afterwards, I was really cross and I went out with my husband. Well, he was my boyfriend then, but my husband now. And I walked past a big publishing house and I was all feisty from where I'd gone wrong. And I said, they're going to publish my book one day. And he turned around to me and said, well, why not? Your application form was really funny. You're obviously a better writer than you are a speaker. So give it a go. And that's how it happened.
And a romantic novelist was born.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And actually, the way you met your husband is like something out of a romantic novel as well.
Yeah, I mean, we met in Kathmandu. We were both going trekking. And we went on a trek around Everest Base Camp. And we got to know each other on our trip. And then I asked him out, I think it was about 5,000 metres. It was very high up, so we were all suffering a little bit of altitude sickness. So my husband likes to joke that he only said yes because we're all suffering altitude sickness. Anything to shut me up, I think, at that point, yeah.
And your last two novels, It Started With a Tweet and We Just Clicked, are both available as R&IB talking books. You must be delighted that you're reaching an audience who would not otherwise be able to access your books.
Yeah, absolutely. I've recently got really into audiobooks and I've become such a convert. So I think it's brilliant. Everybody is able to access my books.
There are many ridiculous things I have done in the name of the gram. Walking past restaurants that I know have mouth-wateringly delicious meals, only to eat at mediocre places because their food is more photogenic. Standing alone on the South Bank, posing like I'm in Britain's Next Top Model, whilst discreetly pressing the remote for my camera. Maxing out my credit card to bring home an ideal hashtag outfit of the day wardrobe, only to take all the items back after I'd snapped myself in them. But being wrapped up in 3 20-metre rolls of cling film in an attempt to snare a lucrative marketing campaign probably takes the biscuit. Are we sure this is a good idea? I ask, staring at the rolls of cling film in Marissa's hands like they're a deadly weapon. It's a great idea. It's going to be fantastic, she says. Of course she'd say that. She came up with it. It is the perfect Halloween costume, and probably the easiest one.
Sophie Roberts, narrating We Just Clicked, written by my guest, Anna Bell. Do you hear the dialogue in your head clearly whilst you're writing?
As I'm writing it, I almost say it aloud in my head so I can really hear the characters. It's actually quite interesting because I've spoken to other authors and I think we all assumed that we all wrote in the same way, but it's come to light recently that we all write very differently. So I almost am watching a movie when I write my books. So I can just almost see the characters in front of me and then I hear them speak. But then I make sure that the dialogue works afterward. I really concentrate on dialogue because I know, especially when you're listening to an audiobook or when you're reading a book, it can really seem very clunky. And so I like it to seem as natural as possible. So after I have written it, I also read it back to myself.
I suppose it's even more important in rom-coms than other genres because that dialogue has to be quite snappy between your characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And also because you don't get these big internal monologues that you might do in more sort of literary fiction and you don't have vast descriptions. The action happens very quickly, so you have to get to the point. And yeah, as you say, the dialogue is usually where the snappy one-liners come back and where the humour really takes effect. And also, I think for me, with the kind of books that I write, because there's often lots of different supporting characters that are quite funny, that's when you see their personality.
I know also that you are somebody who likes to step away from the keyboard and have a good think about the plot and then come back to something if it's not working. And you've got furry friends who help you in that.
I do. I've got a trusty Labrador who I've had for my whole writing career. But then about 6 months ago, we adopted another dog. So we have now a Labrador cross. And I tell you what, they are the perfect writing companion because whenever I get stuck, I look over at them. They look at me and they tell me it's time for a walk and off we go. And we're very lucky that we live in the countryside, so we can go for a nice walk as long as the weather's good. And I think, and it's usually on those walks where you get some fresh air and I'm on my own and the dogs are busy sniffing away and not distracting me. And that's usually when I can untangle plots.
And I understand that you're hard at work with the plot of the next novel as well.
Yes, the next novel is called The Man I Didn't Marry. And I've just finished writing the proper first draft of it. And it's going to be a good one, I think. It's going to be really, really fun. And it's about a husband who loses his memory and he can't remember his wife. And it's all about how the wife tries to get him to remember her and to fall back in love with her.
Well, I wish you all the best with that and hope that you'll come back onto the show in the future. But for now, Annabelle, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you ever so much for having me, and I'll be delighted to come back. It's so lovely to speak to you, and I hope that everybody enjoys We Just Clicked.
We Just Clicked joins It Started With a Tweet in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helplines open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
Now it's back to Annabelle for the books of her life. Anna, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I think the book that sticks in my mind the most from when I was younger, and it's probably a bit of a cliche to choosing a Blighton, but Five Go to Treasure Island was the first book that I really, really remember my mum reading to me. And it was the first famous Five book that I read. I had chicken pox at the time, so I remember every day when I was at home, she would read it to me. And then from then on, I just read every famous Five book, every Secret Seven book I could get my hands on. And I think from there, my love of reading just escalated because I suddenly realized that I could read, because I was seven at the time, I could read myself, and I had this whole world available to me. And there's something about Enid Blyton books now, they don't translate very well. I've tried to read them to my children, but there's something about that time of these, the spirit of adventure that they conjured up in my mind. And since then, I've always just been fascinated by those kind of stories.
The children's aunt arranged a picnic for them the next day, and they all went off to a little cove, not far off, where they could bathe and paddle to their heart's content. They had a wonderful day, but secretly, Julian, Dick and Anne wished they could have visited George's Island. They would rather have done that than anything. George didn't want to go for the picnic, not because she disliked picnics, but because she couldn't take her dog. Her mother went with the children, and George had to pass a whole day without her beloved Timothy. "Bad luck," said Julian, who guessed what she was brooding about.
I can't think why you don't tell your mother about old Tim. I'm sure she wouldn't mind you letting someone else keep him for you. I know my mother wouldn't.
I'm not going to tell anybody but you, said George. I get into awful trouble at home always. I dare say it's my fault, but I get a bit tired of it. You see, Daddy doesn't make much money with the learned books he writes, and he's always wanting to give Mother and me things he can't afford, so that makes him bad-tempered. He wants to send me away to a good school, but he hasn't got the money. I'm glad. I don't want to go away to school. I like being here. I couldn't bear to part with Timothy.
You'd like boarding school, said Anne. We all go. It's fun.
No, it isn't, said George obstinately. It must be awful to be one of a crowd, to have other girls all laughing and yelling round you. I should hate it.
No, you wouldn't, said Anne. All that is great fun. It would be good for you, George, I should think.
If you start telling me what is good for me, I shall hate you, said George, suddenly looking very fierce.
Jan Francis, narrating Five on a Treasure Island by Enid Blyton. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I don't often reread books, but there is a book that I read recently over the last couple of years called You, Me, Everything by Catherine Isaac. And I don't know what it is about the book. It's a fantastic story. It's set in France and it's a lovely emotional story about a woman who has a son and she goes to France to reconnect with the boy's father, well, for them to have a relationship. And it's just so evocative of the scenery and the emotion that's involved in this relationship and finding out what happened in the past to have gone wrong. And I just love it. And I've read it about 3 or 4 times. As I said, I never reread books. So if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it.
Manchester, England, 2006. Sometimes life takes the best and worst it has to offer and throws the whole lot at you on the same day. This probably isn't an uncommon conclusion to reach during childbirth, but in my case, it wasn't the usual cocktail of pain and joy that led me to it. It was that, although I was finally about to meet the tiny human who'd shared my body for 9 months, those 8 agonizing hours were also spent trying to reach his father on my mobile, to drag him away from whatever bar, club, or other woman he was in. Did you remember to bring your notes, Jessica? The midwife asked after I'd arrived at the hospital alone. I've got my notes. It's my boyfriend I've mislaid, I said, through an apologetic smile. She glanced up at me from under her eyelashes as I leaned on the reception desk of the delivery suite, waiting for the searing pain in my belly to pass. I'm sure he'll be on his way soon. Sweat gathered on the back of my neck. I've left him a couple of messages. 12, to be exact. He's at a work event. He probably can't get a signal. At this stage, part of me was still hoping this was true. I always was determined to see the good in Adam, even in the face of clear evidence to the contrary. We never used to have men here, she reminded me. So if we need to do it without Dad, we'll be just fine. Dad. I couldn't deny the biological facts, but the title sounded wrong when it was applied to Adam. The midwife looked reassuringly matronly, with stout legs, a bosom you could stand a potted plant on, and the kind of hair that had been in foam curlers overnight. The name on her badge was Mary. I'd known Mary for about 3 minutes and I already liked her, which was good, given that she was about to examine my cervix.
Tanya Rodriguez, narrating You, Me, Everything by Catherine Isaac, which is available commercially, and you'll find Braille copies in the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, it's called Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. And it's really hard to describe as a novel. It's basically written in a documentary style that you're watching a sort of an iconic pop band from the 1970s, or you're listening to them being interviewed. And so each little bit is a little snippet of information or a little snippet of the interview from different band members that make up this fictional band called Daisy Jones and the Six. And it's part love story, part behind the scenes of a band. And it's just, it's a really strange book to describe, but it's utterly compelling. And you get really sucked into the story, even though you don't know the back, but you just want to know about them. It's about them making what was supposedly in the book like an iconic album. So I think it's based around sort of people like Fleetwood Mac and as bands of sort of that ilk. But it's just absolutely fascinating if you ever wondered what it would be like to be a groupie in the 70s and what actually went on in those bands where there was interrelationships and sex, drugs and rock and roll, really, but in a really nice form. So just very different.
Elaine Chang, biographer, author of Daisy Jones, Wildflower. Here is what is so captivating about Daisy Jones, even before she was Daisy Jones. You've got a rich white girl growing up in L.A. She's gorgeous, even as a child. She has these stunning big blue eyes, dark cobalt blue. One of my favorite anecdotes about her is that in the 80s, a colored contact company actually created a shade called Daisy Blue. She's got copper red hair that is thick and wavy and takes up so much space. And then her cheekbones almost seem swollen. That's how defined they are. And she's got an incredible voice that she doesn't cultivate, never takes a lesson. She's born with all the money in the world, access to whatever she wants, artists, drugs, clubs, anything and everything at her disposal. But she has no one, no siblings, no extended family in Los Angeles, two parents who are so into their own world that they are all but indifferent to her existence. Although they never shy away from making her pose for their artist friends. That's why there are so many paintings and photos of Daisy as a child. The artists that came into that home saw Daisy Jones, saw how gorgeous she was, and wanted to capture her. It's telling that there is no Frank Jones piece of Daisy. Her father is too busy with his male nudes to pay much attention to his daughter. And in general, Daisy spends her childhood rather alone. But she's actually a very gregarious, outgoing kid.
Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is read by a cast of narrators, and it's available commercially in a full range of formats. Annabel, thank you so much for sharing your obvious enthusiasm for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to all my guests, producer Hannah, and to all of you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.